7. Extermination. They say that time feels like it slows down in revolutionary or historic moments, and we know that in moments of trauma or violence, time can nearly come to a stop. When eyewitnesses and victims talk about the 6 months after September 30th, 1965, they speak differently. Elderly men and women who talk about other parts of their lives in terms of years or decades begin to talk about weeks, specific dates, hours, and minutes. The now public U.S. government communications reporting on the same events are also very specific about dates. In deference to the manner that these two very different types of voices can now speak to us, what follows is a selected timeline of these months. October 5th. Jakarta. October 5th is Armed Forces Day in Indonesia. In the capital, the army usually holds a parade. In 1965, it held a state funeral for the fallen generals and a demonstration of the military's new dominance. Sukarno refrained from attending out of fear for his safety. The president now had to publicly back the new military leadership or appear to support the defeated and discredited, indeed apparently demonic, September 30th movement. Defense Minister Nasution gave an impassioned speech condemning the treachery of the communist rebellion and recognizing Suharto's leadership. Around the archipelago, local chapters of the Indonesian Communist Party participated in the festivities as they always would, proudly waving their hammer and sickle flags alongside the military celebrations. Washington, D.C. The State Department received a cable from the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta on October 5th, signed by Ambassador Howard Green. Green outlined the situation in Indonesia. Following guidelines may supply part of the answer to what our posture should be. A. Avoid overt involvement as power struggle unfolds. B. Covertly, however, indicate clearly to key people in army, such as Nasution and Suharto, our desire to be of assistance where we can, while at same time conveying to them our assumption that we should avoid appearance of involvement or interference in any way. C. Maintain and, if possible, extend our contact with military. D. Avoid moves that might be interpreted as note of non-confidence in army, such as precipitately, sick, moving out our dependents or cutting staff. E. Spread the story of PKI's guilt, treachery, and brutality. This priority effort is perhaps most needed immediate assistance we can give Army if we find way to do it without identifying it as solely or largely U.S. effort. The new ambassador sent another, more direct summary of what lay before Washington in Indonesia that same day. He wrote, "The Army now has the opportunity to move against Communist Party if it moves quickly," he wrote. "It's now or never." October 7. Banda Aceh. The province of Aceh, at the top of the large, rich island of Sumatra, has a history of both communism and fervent Muslim faith. Indeed, they often overlapped in the days when Indonesia had a flowering of Islamic communism, and most PKI members in the region were devout believers. Aceh, hot and dense and dark green, is the westernmost point of Indonesia, with Malaysia to its east across the Straits of Malacca. The armed forces had organized a number of civilians there as part of Sukarno's confrontasi with that young nation. According to interviews with Achenese peoples at the time, the PKI did not have a bad reputation, even among very conservative Muslims, until the anti-communist propaganda started arriving after October 1st. Aceh's military commander in 1965 was Ishak Juwarsa, an avid anti-communist who had studied at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. On October 7th, he left the capital, Banda Aceh, for a whirlwind tour of the province, giving speeches to quickly assembled crowds. "The PKI are kafir, infidels," he announced, according to eyewitness reports. "I will destroy them down to their roots. If in the village you find members of the PKI but do not kill them, it will be you who we punish." Juwarsa led the crowd in a chant, "Crush the PKI, crush the PKI, crush the PKI." Locals in central Aceh understood, they recall, that they were being instructed to help kill the communists or be killed themselves. It is believed the mass murder started that day on the island of Sumatra. Some of the killings were spontaneous, carried out by civilians acting on their own after receiving orders like this, but that was not the rule. The military and police started arresting a huge number of people. Many leftists turned themselves in, thinking it was the safe and prudent thing to do. The military put to use civilian structures it had created during the anti-Malaysia campaign. During Konfrontasi, the military had built up paramilitary organizations that could be used to implement martial law and repress the communists. The phrase used by Dzhuarsa, down to the roots, had already been used once before, at midnight on October 1st, by Mokojinta, another commander in Sumatra who had studied at Leavenworth. These words would become a constant public refrain of the mass murder program. October 8. The army newspaper Angkatan Bersenjata published a cartoon of a man striking a tree trunk with an axe. On the tree is written G30S, the Indonesian language acronym for the September 30th movement, and the roots spell PKI, the Communist Party. The caption reads, "Exterminate them down to the roots." Internally, however, the Indonesian army had a different name. It called this Operasi Penumpasan, Operation Annihilation. October 19. Jakarta. Magdalena barely noticed that there had been a bit of political chaos in early October in the capital. She certainly didn't know things back in Central Java, where she grew up, were much worse than they were in Jakarta. Her grandmother had fallen ill, so she got time off from her job at the t-shirt factory and took a train back to her village to visit her. Health problems had plagued her family her whole life. By the time she arrived, her grandmother had already passed. The plan was to attend the funeral and spend a week, maybe two, grieving with the family, then get back to work in Jakarta. She went to bed in her childhood home in Purwokerto. October 20. Washington, D.C. The State Department received a cable from Ambassador Howard Green. Green reported that the PKI had suffered some damage to its organizational strength through arrest, harassment, and in some cases, execution of PKI cadres. He continued, "If army repression of PKI continues and army refuses to give up its position of power to Sukarno, PKI strength can be cut back. In long run, however, army repression of PKI will not be successful unless it is willing to attack communism as such." Green concluded, "Army has nevertheless been working hard at destroying PKI, and I, for one, have increasing respect for its determination and organization in carrying out this crucial assignment." Purwokerto, Central Java. In the early afternoon, two police officers arrived at Magdalena's family home less than 24 hours after her arrival. "You're coming with us. We need some information from you," they told her. The entire house erupted, crying, screaming. Magdalena's family had heard some people were arrested recently in the neighborhood, but they didn't know she was a member of a Sabsi union in Jakarta, and neither they nor Magdalena knew that could ever be a problem in the first place. At the police station, officers began to yell at her, interrogating her. They told her they knew she was a member of the Gerwani, the women's movement affiliated with the Communist Party. She wasn't. She didn't know what to say to them except that she wasn't. According to the mythology spread by Indonesia's new command, this meant she was part of the group that danced naked while mutilating the military high command's genitals. She was in Jakarta, they said. Maybe she was even at the slaughter. She didn't know anything about this, she told them. These interrogations started and stopped and started again for 7 days. Then the officers took her to another police station in Semarang. As soon as she arrived, she collapsed. She was sick or overwhelmed. She was dizzy all over. She was 17 years old. She's not sure how long she was at the second police station before two police officers raped her. She was Gerwani in the minds of the police, which meant that she was not a human being and not a woman, but a sexually depraved murderer, an enemy of Indonesia and Islam, a witch. These men were in charge of her now. October 22. Washington. The State Department received detailed reports of the extent and nature of the army operations as killings began in Java. A Muslim youth leader reported that assistants were accompanying troops on sweeps that led to killings. National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy wrote to President Johnson that events in Indonesia since September 30 are so far a striking vindication of U.S. policy toward that nation in recent years. The same day, Ambassador Marshall Green sent a cable to the State Department. "As yet, there is no indication army incapable. We agree that it would be virtually impossible to keep secret any direct USG, U.S. government, assistance. If assistance were given and it became known, we question whether Army would be helped rather than hurt. We suspect that if military authorities ever really needed our help in this matter, they would let us know. 2 weeks later, the White House authorized the CIA station in Bangkok to provide small arms to its military contact in Central Java for use against the PKI, alongside medical supplies that would come in from the CIA station in Bangkok. But after 7 years of close cooperation with Washington, the military was already well-equipped. You also don't need very advanced weaponry to arrest civilians who provide almost no resistance. What officials in the embassy and the CIA decided the Army really did need, however, was information. Working with CIA analysts, embassy political officer Robert Martins prepared lists with the names of thousands of communists and suspected communists and handed them over to the Army so that these people could be murdered and checked off the list. As far as we know, this was at least the third time in history that U.S. officials had supplied lists of communists and alleged communists to allies so that they could round them up and kill them. The first was in Guatemala in 1954, the second was in Iraq in 1963, and now on a much larger scale was Indonesia, 1965. It really was a big help to the Army, said Martins, who was a member of the U.S. Embassy's political section. I probably have a lot of blood on my hands, but that's not all bad. October 25. Purbalinga, Central Java. Sakono woke up early and rode his bicycle 6 kilometers toward the local police station. He arrived, walked in, and signed his name on a little piece of paper. The officers were casual about the whole thing and basically polite. This was routine by now. When Sakono first heard about the September 30th movement, he was sympathetic. As he understood it from radio reports, it was an internal army movement that stopped a coup against his childhood hero, President Sukarno. But then news became a bit more confused. The People's Daily no longer arrived in his village. His local chapter of the People's Youth Organization didn't give him any answers either, so he just kept waiting to start his job as a schoolteacher, desperate for scraps of news from Jakarta, as he had been since he was a teen. As the narrative around the events shifted, with only military and foreign media reporting on them, Sakono knew that the left was under some suspicion, but he didn't really consider it a big deal. He got word that everyone in a communist-affiliated organization had to check in regularly with the police. Though he had never dealt with law enforcement before, he didn't mind this much. He didn't have a lot to do, and he wasn't worried. Whatever had happened in Jakarta didn't affect his plans. He figured he would be the best revolutionary he could be as a teacher. When education moves forward, the country moves forward, he thought. He continued waiting, helping out his family with the crops, just passing the time. October 29, Galena, Maryland. Frank Wisner found one of his son's shotguns while staying at the family farm and used it to kill himself. November 2, Purbalinga, Central Java. Sakono checked in with the police once more. Once more, he walked out of the station, then got on his bike and rode back to his village. When he got home, around 2 in the afternoon, a pair of police officers were waiting for him. One of them was holding a letter. They told him the letter meant he had to go with them. "This is of the utmost importance," the police officer said. "You need to face this now." So he went with them. When Sakono entered prison, he felt just fine. He had done nothing wrong, so he figured he would just do some interviews, provide some information, and clear his name. He wasn't a full member of the PKI himself, but he had been variously and proudly involved with the Communist Party since he was very young, so he immediately ran into a lot of old friends. There was Sutrisno, the party cadre who had given him classes in Marxism-Leninism when he was younger. Suhada, his short, slightly chubby older friend who always wore sunglasses, was there too. He was in the party's central committee, a funny guy who always gave amazing speeches. It was practically a reunion. The mood was light, almost festive. They began singing revolutionary songs together, not even in defiance of the police, but just in a kind of joyful solidarity. Move forward undaunted, defend what is right. Forward, together, of course we win. Move forward, all together, all together. That night, while everyone was sleeping, they took away 12 of the prisoners. They took away Sutrisno. They took away Suhada. They took away his friends, Kamdi and Sumarno and Suharho. They never came back. No one ate breakfast the next morning. There was no more singing, no more cheer, no one talked. This couldn't be happening. It went against everything Sukarno had learned and believed his entire life. The military and the police were defenders of the revolution. Indonesia had a system of law and order, of fair trial, of evidence and justice. He had barely seen any violence in the 19 years since he was born. I'm not a rebel. I've never held a weapon. I would never rebel against my country. I never did anything wrong in my whole life, Sukarno shouted over and over. But silently inside his own mind, as his body quivered, terrified he would be in the next group to be taken away. What had happened to his friends? Sukarno heard rumors, as did everyone in the region. They were taking some people to the Serayu River in the middle of the night. They tied up their hands and threw them into the water. Or maybe they shot them first, or maybe they stabbed them. That there were mass killings became obvious. There were so many bodies piling up that they were blocking rivers and unleashing a horrible stench across the country. But as to who was killed and where and how, all the survivors had were rumors. This was a new characteristic of the mass violence. People weren't killed in the streets, making it very clear to families that they were gone. They weren't officially executed. They were arrested and then disappeared in the middle of the night. Loved ones often had no idea if their relatives were still alive, making them even more paralyzed with fear. If they complained or rebelled, could that be what cost their imprisoned loved ones their lives? Might they be taken too? Even in the face of overwhelming evidence that mass murder is occurring, the human instinct is to hold out hope that your son or your daughter might still be saved. This freezes people and makes populations much more quiescent, easier to exterminate and easier to control. Historians who study violence in Asia believe this was the first time forced disappearances had been used. Who murdered them? Just as in Aceh, military and police took captives to special locations at night and killed them. But very often, it was not the actual uniformed officers who pulled the trigger or plunged the machete into human flesh. The country's largest Muslim organization had a youth wing and an armed wing, the Ansar and Bansar. These were acronyms, but the founder of the Bansar said that he wanted the word to sound like Panzer, Hitler's famous tanks. He also said he had been studying Mein Kampf starting in 1964 in order to learn how to deal with the communists. These groups participated in the killings in Central and East Java. In Aceh, the military press ganged and threatened suspicious civilians, politically suspect individuals, or outcasts into carrying out the murders. Afterward, they would often down alcohol to numb themselves to what they had just done. Whatever happened, whoever it was, almost all of Sukarno's friends were gone now, and corpses were piling up everywhere. November 6, Washington, D.C. The State Department received a cable from Jakarta. The U.S. Embassy passed on some more reports of Army progress. The message ended precisely as follows. E Army Info Bureau also reported that paracommandos, RPKAD, in armored vehicles entering the city of Surakarta, no date given, were blocked in village at outskirts by 9 witches from PKI women's affiliate Gurwani, who insulted them and refused to let them pass. After asking them quietly to give way and firing into air, paracommandos were forced by their intransigence to terminate breathing of these 9 Gurwani witches. 3. Miscellaneous, sick. Beginning what we believe will be major fad, Bandung renamed part of its main street General Yani Boulevard yesterday. It's good he has an easily pronounceable name. Green. November 22. Boyolali. The armed forces found, arrested, and executed Dian Adit, the leader of the Indonesian Communist Party in Boyolali, Central Java, on the morning of November 22nd. Adit had been on the run in Central Java since he realized that the military was after him. The military told the world Adit confessed to plans to take over the country, and this account was later published in Newsweek. After the issue came out, a cable from the embassy told the State Department that embassy staff knew it was impossible to believe that Adit had made such a statement because, according to the military's version, he allegedly referenced a fake document, one they knew was obviously being disseminated as part of an anti-communist black propaganda operation. December 13, Jakarta. Franziska kept working in the days after October 1st, 1965. Zane stopped working after the People's Daily was closed down by the military, but Franziska kept going to the Afro-Asian Journalist Association office every day, and the staff continued working on preparations for their next edition and for the Tricontinental Conference planned for Havana in 1966. Despite everything that was happening, Sukarno and a senior Communist Party leader, Nyoto, had managed to convene a conference in Jakarta in protest of U.S. military bases around the world, and Franziska had helped Afro-Asian journalist cover it in October. But Franziska knew people were being arrested all around the capital. Some of her colleagues, especially the journalists, stopped showing up for work. Still, there was almost no reliable information as to what was going on. Everyone was keeping to themselves. No one knew whom they could trust. Every night, Franziska took the car straight back from the office to her home with Zane in Menteng. She had lived 2 months like this, as the world of left-wing intellectuals in Jakarta was getting smaller and smaller. At 4 in the morning on December 13th, 3 men knocked on their door and took them both away. Franziska and Zane went peacefully into police custody. The officers told Franziska she was only being brought in for questioning and that she would be home very soon, then loaded her and Zane into a Land Rover and drove to Independence Square. The kids were left alone in the house. Soon after they got there, the men took Zane into a different room. Franziska saw a man begin to undo his belt as he entered another door. She was left with a military officer in an interrogation room. He pulled out a gun and put it on the table in front of her. She lost contact with her senses. She was certain she was going to die. Somehow, she made it through. The interrogation was over. It might have lasted an hour or several. She was in a daze. They brought her to the office of the military doctor, the one who treated the wives of the officers. Why was she there? Maybe to be killed in a different way? Then they brought Zane in. It became apparent he was there to say goodbye. It was also apparent he had been tortured. She could see cigarette burns up and down his arms. How many, she didn't know. Too hard to count. Then he was gone, and she was alone in the doctor's office. She languished there for 8 days. At night, she would sleep on a kind of bench, seemingly an examination table that gynecologists used. She didn't eat, and she lost maybe 15 pounds. She didn't know. She didn't know anything. During the daytime, the doctors would ignore her as they worked, seemingly unsure why she was there, but knowing she was some sort of a communist, and therefore undeserving of treatment. But a patient, another woman, probably a soldier's wife, noticed her. Franziska was sobbing uncontrollably. She didn't know where her children were. She didn't know if Damayati or Candida or Anthony or her youngest, Benjamino, were okay. For days, the police had ignored her tears. But this woman saw her and asked her what was wrong. Franziska tried to tell her. You have children? The woman asked. I have 4, Franziska said, and broke down again. She turned to the doctor and shouted, Why are you not taking care of this woman? The doctor gave in and granted just a little of her humanity back. He must have called someone because Franziska was transferred to the military office. It turned out the police had processed her incorrectly and they forgot about her. Now she was taken to the women's prison, still no contact with her family. At the women's prison, she met a younger girl, only 19, a country girl pregnant with her first child. She looked up to Franziska, an older mother, now 39 years old. The young woman was sobbing uncontrollably and told Franziska her husband had already been killed. December 16, Washington, D.C. U.S. officials were in close contact with the military, making it clear to them that direct assistance could resume if the PKI were destroyed, Sukarno was removed, and attacks on U.S. investments halted. Aid flows were also conditional on Indonesia's willingness to adopt IMF and U.S.-approved economic plans. All army leaders seemed to want to know, according to a State Department cable in December, was, how much is it worth to us that PKI be smashed? It was worth a lot. But U.S. officials were also very alarmed that the military government in waiting had not yet reversed Sukarno's plans to take over U.S. oil companies, by far their most important economic concern at the time. They bluntly and repeatedly warned the emerging Indonesian leadership that if nationalization went forward, support from Washington would be withheld and their grip on power was at stake, according to historian Bradley Simpson's analysis of the declassified communications. The White House enlisted Australian and Japanese officials in the fight. They won. On December 16th, a telegram from Jakarta to the State Department described the victory. Suharto arrived at a high-level meeting by helicopter, strode into the room, and made it crystal clear to all assembled that the military would not stand for precipitous moves against oil companies. Then he walked out. January 1, 1966. Bali. The violence arrived on the island of Bali in December. It's almost like it started at Indonesia's westernmost tip and moved east across the main population centers through Central Java to East Java and then to Bali, like the movement of the sun, only precisely in reverse. The slaughter in Bali was probably the worst in all of Indonesia. As the new year began, the island convulsed with violence. Agung Alit was just a little boy, but he knew they were looking for his father. His father, Raka, knew it too. So instead of sleeping at home, he went to sleep in the nearby Hindu temple. Agung stayed at home. As he slept, men came to their home night after night, rummaging around, demanding to know where Raka was. Finally, they got him. Agung was awoken, and his family told him his father was gone. They weren't sure when he would be back. The people of Bali knew something was very suspicious about the outbreak of violence. People were being killed with big machetes. Machetes are not native to the island. Balinese people use the klewang, a thinner, local blade. Someone must have brought the heavy weapons in from another island, and, as elsewhere, locals were participating in the killing. Agung heard that it was actually a neighbor, a man known by the family, who took away his father. The machetes arrived around the same time that military anti-communist propaganda campaigns, nationally coordinated, arrived in Bali. One rumor declared that Gerwani women had plans to sell their bodies in order to buy weapons for a communist revolt and to castrate the soldiers they seduced. Propaganda teams toured rural areas, spreading stories like this, driving home the message that people must be on the side of the G30S or stand behind the government in crushing the G30S. There is no such thing as a neutral position. Some killings were carried out by members of the PNI, the nationalist party Sukarno had founded long ago, as well as local paramilitary gangs that had already been opposing the government's national land reform program. Young Wayan Badra, the 13-year-old son of the Hindu priest in the Seminyak neighborhood, noticed that the two nice communist teachers at his school went away and never came back. Then he heard what was happening on the beaches. They were bringing people from the city to the east to kill them on the sand. It was public property there and empty at night. The bodies were abandoned there. Some families came to recover them. Others were gathered by Badra's village to be given anonymous funeral rites and cremated by his father. For Balinese Hindus, the loss of a family member's body is a deep spiritual tragedy of infinite consequence. So a few years after the violence ended, Agung went with his family to find his father's body and give him an honorable funeral and cremation. They walked 4 kilometers to the site where someone told them they could find his remains. They found a field of bodies. They began looking through bones, picking up skulls. Someone shouted, "This is Mr. Raka!" But no, that skull didn't look right. Maybe the hair was wrong. Maybe that one? They kept sorting through decomposing bodies desperately for minutes before someone realized it was impossible, crazy. There were just too many skulls, too many skeletons. They walked back home for an hour, processing the knowledge they would never lay him to rest and sickened by the vast sea of humanity they had just entered. In total, at least 5% of the population of Bali was killed, that is 80,000 people, probably the highest proportion in the country. The Balinese had been especially strong supporters of Sukarno's multi-faith political project because it gave Hindus more freedom in a Muslim-majority country. A severe economic crisis in the early 1960s made the communists' promise of redistribution more attractive to some and more threatening to others. The PNI killed Suteja, the governor, and members of his family, and spread the myth that he actually chose to Niupat, or volunteer to be executed and be reincarnated as a better person. Some Balinese were indeed asked if they wanted to Niupat or not, but those who said no were killed anyway, rendering the question meaningless. They were executed, murdered one by one over just a few months for affiliation with an unarmed political party that had been entirely legal and mainstream just weeks earlier. A little bit later, the first tourist hotel went up on the very beach, Seminyak, that had been used as a killing field. January 14, Washington, D.C. The State Department received a detailed assessment of the Indonesian situation from Ambassador Marshall Green. Prior to October 1, 1965, Indonesia was for all practical purposes an Asian communist state. Events of the past several months have had three major effects on Indonesia's power structures and policies. 1. The PKI has ceased for the foreseeable future to be an important power element. Effective action by the army and its Muslim allies has totally disrupted the party's organizational apparatus. Most Politburo and Central Committee members have been killed or arrested, and estimates of the number of party members killed range up to several hundred thousand. The memo listed the plan for the U.S. response. 1. Ensure that our actions and statements do nothing to shore up Sukarno and his henchmen. F. Without becoming directly involved, promote arrangements between the government of Indonesia and the American oil companies. H. Within the limits of prudence, give open or covert advice and assistance to responsible and competent anti-communist groups for worthwhile activities. March 11, Bogor. As the killings went on, State Department officials repeatedly expressed frustration that Suharto had not yet taken full control and formally deposed President Sukarno. Since October, Sukarno had been largely relegated to the palace in the city of Bogor and stripped of most of his powers, but he still had his official title and some influence. Sukarno's reaction to the killings was both resignation and desperation. Though he wasn't getting full reports from around the country, he knew violence was taking place and seemed overwhelmed by the avalanche of anti-communist propaganda. He told one group of officers and journalists, "Over and over, it's the same thing. Razors, 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 razors. A grave for 1,000 people, a grave for 1,000 people. Over and over again, the same thing." He urged restraint, entirely ineffectively, as Suharto's forces literally hacked away at the number of people on the left wing of Indonesian politics. Over the period of killings, the economic situation deteriorated, reducing further what remained of Sukarno's power. According to Subandrio, his former foreign minister, Suharto intentionally engineered hyperinflation by working with businessmen to restrict the supply of basic goods like rice, sugar, and cooking oil. Suharto encouraged anti-communist student groups, often drawn from the same schools Benny had attended just years earlier, to protest those high prices. The U.S. government was intentionally destabilizing the economy. As student protests raged around him, Sukarno called top government officials to the Jakarta Presidential Palace on March 10th in an attempt to retain control. Instead, paratroopers loyal to Suharto, led by General Sarwo Edi, surrounded him the next day. Sukarno jumped on a helicopter to flee, Subandrio running behind him barefoot, and rushed back to Bogor. But there, Sukarno was forced to sign a letter handing over executive power to Suharto. There are still controversies about this letter, the so-called Super Semar. No one has ever seen the original. Regardless, Suharto used it as permission to take over immediately and completely. In his first acts, he officially banned what was left of the Communist Party, then arrested much of Sukarno's cabinet, including Subandrio. The United States immediately opened the economic floodgates. The stranglehold on the economy was loosened, and U.S. firms began exploring opportunities for profit. Within days of the transfer of power, representatives from the U.S. mining company Freeport were in the jungles of West New Guinea and quickly found a mountain filled with valuable minerals. Ertsberg, as it is now called, is the largest gold mine on the planet. March 17, Washington, D.C. Incoming cable from Jakarta. 1. Several American correspondents here have sought our comments on reports from Jakarta, which we have traced to high-level British sources in Singapore. AP correspondent John Cantwell, Protect Source, told Conjen flatly that British are planting stories. The reporter knew he had been receiving misinformation as part of a campaign to strengthen Suharto. He didn't mind. The memo continues, correspondent complained that although he was reasonably certain British were feeding him false or misleading information, their stories were so spectacular he had no choice but to file them. Date unknown. After 5 months, Francisca walked out of prison. Her father found a way to use his money and influence to pay for her release. Disoriented, she had no idea what day it was. Broadly speaking, the violence in Jakarta was not as intense as it was in places like North Sumatra, Central and East Java, and Bali. Perhaps because those were the main centers of mass support for the PKI and for Sukarno himself, and perhaps because they couldn't treat leftists in the capital, surrounded by press and elites and diplomats, the same way they were treating regular people far from the city. But the world Francisca discovered upon her release was still devastating. Her house had been covered with violent graffiti, smeared with G30S, the September 30th movement. She was able to see her kids, finally. They were okay, but she found out that her oldest daughter had been taken out of class one day by the military, loaded onto a truck, and taken to Independence Square, where she was forced to line up and chant, "Down with Sukarno! Down with Sukarno!" She knew that this chant was aimed at her father and mother, who had disappeared, for being on what was now considered the wrong side of history. None of Francisca's friends would talk to her anymore. In fact, no one was talking to anyone. Gone were the days of literary discussions and language classes with progressive intellectuals from around the world. There was a new rule of conduct. You shouldn't trust anybody, she recalled. They were using people from every type of organization to snitch on their former colleagues. So many people just can't stand the abuse. They break down and betray their friends and their own organization. The less you know, the better it is. Zane was not there. He never emerged from prison. A gleam of light. Most of the Western press repeated the narrative being peddled by the new Indonesian government, which Washington was enthusiastically welcoming onto the world stage. That story went, more or less, that some spontaneous violence erupted when regular people found out about what the communists had done or been planning. These articles said that the natives had run amok and engaged in bloodshed. Because the word amok originated in Malay, the language that formed the basis for both Indonesian and Malaysian, this made it easier for Western journalists to employ Orientalist stereotypes about Asians as primitive, backward, and violent people, and blame the violence on a putative, sudden, irrational outburst. On April 13, 1966, C.L. Sulzberger penned a piece, one of many in this genre, with the headline, "When a Nation Runs Amok," for the New York Times. As Sulzberger described it, the killings occurred in violent Asia, where life is cheap. He reproduced the lie that Communist Party members had killed the generals on October 1st and that Gerwani women slashed and tortured them. He went on to affirm that Indonesians are gentle, but hidden behind their smiles is that strange Malay streak, that inner frenzied bloodlust which has given to other languages one of their few Malay words, amok. The Malay and now Indonesian concept of amok actually referred to a traditional form of ritual suicide, even if the Anglicization now refers to wild violence more generally. But there's no reason to believe that the mass violence of 1965 to 66 has its roots in native culture. No one has any evidence of mass murder of this kind happening in Indonesian history, except for when foreigners were involved. The story of inexplicable, vaguely tribal violence, so easy for American readers to digest, was entirely false. This was organized state violence with a clear purpose. The main obstacles to a complete military takeover were eliminated by a coordinated program of extermination, the intentional mass murder of innocent civilians. The generals were able to take power after state terror sufficiently weakened their political opponents, who had no weapons, only public sympathy. They didn't resist their own annihilation because they had no idea what was coming. In total, it is estimated that between 500,000 and 1 million people were slaughtered, and 1 million more were herded into concentration camps. Sarwo Edie, the man who ambushed Sukarno in March, once bragged that the military had killed 3 million people. There's a reason we have to settle for estimates, because for more than 50 years, the Indonesian government has resisted any attempt to go out and record what happened, and no one around the world has much cared to ask either. Millions more people were indirect victims of the massacres, but no one came around to inquire how many loved ones they had lost. Their silence was the point of the violence. The armed forces did not oversee the extermination of every single communist, alleged communist, and potential communist sympathizer in the country. That would have been nearly impossible, because around a quarter of the country was affiliated somehow with the PKI. Once the killings took hold, it became incredibly hard to find anyone who would admit to any association with the PKI. Around 15% of the prisoners taken were women. They were subjected to especially cruel gendered violence, which sprung directly from the propaganda spread by Suharto with Western help. Sumiati, the Gurwani member who lived near Sukono in her teens, fled the police for 2 months before turning herself in. She was made to drink the urine of her captors. Other women had their breasts cut off or their genitals mutilated, and rape and sexual slavery were widespread. There has been some debate as to whether the Indonesian mass killings can be categorized as genocide, but that is largely an argument about the meaning of the term, not about what happened. In the overwhelming majority of cases, people were killed for their political beliefs or for being accused of having the wrong political beliefs. It's also true that some murderers used the chaos to settle personal scores and that thousands were killed because of their race. This was especially true for the ethnic Chinese population. But the vast majority of real leftists were no more deserving of any punishment than those who were inaccurately accused of being associated with the Communist Party. Except for a tiny number of people possibly involved in the planning of the disastrous September 30th movement, almost everyone killed and imprisoned was entirely innocent of any crime. Magdalena, an apolitical teenage member of a communist-affiliated union, was innocent. Sukono, an active member of the People's Youth and enthusiastic Marxist, was innocent. His teachers and friends, card-carrying party members all, were innocent. Agung's father in Bali was innocent. Sumiati and the other members of her Gurwani chapter, innocent. Sukono's childhood friends and Magdalena's union comrades didn't deserve to be killed. They didn't even deserve a small fine. They didn't do anything wrong at all. They were sentenced to annihilation, and almost everyone around them was sentenced to a lifetime of guilt, trauma, and being told they had sinned unforgivably because of their association with the earnest hopes of left-wing politics. Declassified documents from Eastern Europe indicate that Zane, Franziska's husband, was a member of the party's central committee. Even in the case of someone like him, at the very top of the Communist Party, there's no evidence Zane was guilty of anything at all. In addition to the crime of extermination, an international people's tribunal assembled later in the Netherlands found the Indonesian military guilty of a number of crimes against humanity, including torture, unjustified and long-term detainment in cruel conditions, forced labor amounting to enslavement, and systematic sexual violence. The judges found that all this was carried out for political purposes, to destroy the Communist Party and then prop up a violent dictatorial regime with the assistance of the United States, the UK, and Australia. It wasn't only US government officials who handed over kill lists to the army. Managers of US-owned plantations furnished them with the names of troublesome communists and union organizers who were then murdered. The prime responsibility for the massacres and concentration camps lies with the Indonesian military. We still do not know if the method employed, disappearance and mass extermination, was planned well before October 1965, perhaps inspired by other cases around the world, or planned under foreign direction, or if it emerged as a solution as events unfolded. But Washington shares guilt for every death. The United States was part and parcel of the operation at every stage, starting well before the killing started, until the last body dropped and the last political prisoner emerged from jail, decades later, tortured, scarred, and bewildered. At several points that we know of, and perhaps some we don't, Washington was the prime mover and provided crucial pressure for the operation to move forward or expand. U.S. strategy since the 1950s had been to try to find a way to destroy the Indonesian Communist Party, not because it was seizing power undemocratically, but because it was popular. In line with Frank Wisner's early strategy of covert direct confrontation, the U.S. government launched secret attacks and murdered civilians in 1958 in the attempt to break up the country and failed. So American officials adopted Howard Jones's more subtle on-the-ground insights, turning to a strategy of building deep connections with the armed forces and building an anti-communist military state within a state. John F. Kennedy's active engagement with the Third World, and especially its military, under the guidance of modernization theory, provided the structure to expand the power of this operation in Indonesia. When Washington parted ways with Jones and his strategy of working directly with Sukarno, it instructed its secret and not-so-secret agents to destabilize the country and create conflict. When the conflict came, and when the opportunity arose, the U.S. government helped spread the propaganda that made the killing possible and engaged in constant conversations with the army to make sure the military officers had everything they needed, from weapons to kill lists. The U.S. embassy constantly prodded the military to adopt a stronger position and take over the government, knowing full well that the method being employed to make this possible was to round up hundreds of thousands of people around the country, stab or strangle them, and throw their corpses into rivers. The Indonesian military officers understood very well that the more people they killed, the weaker the left would be, and the happier Washington would be. Up to 1 million Indonesians, maybe more, were killed as a part of Washington's global anti-communist crusade. The U.S. government expended significant resources over years engineering the conditions for a violent clash, and then when the violence broke out, assisted and guided its longtime partners to carry out the mass murder of civilians as a means of achieving U.S. geopolitical goals. And in the end, U.S. officials got what they wanted. It was a huge victory. As historian John Russo puts it, almost overnight, the Indonesian government went from being a fierce voice for Cold War neutrality and anti-imperialism to a quiet, compliant partner of the U.S. world order. This was something for almost everyone in the U.S. government and elite media circles to celebrate, given the thinking that was dominant at the time. James Reston, a liberal columnist at the New York Times, published a piece under the headline, "A Gleam of Light in Asia." He noted correctly that there was a great deal more contact between the anti-communist forces in that country and at least one very high official in Washington before and during the Indonesian massacre than is generally realized. It is doubtful if the coup would have ever been attempted without the American show of strength in Vietnam, or been sustained without the clandestine aid it has received indirectly from here. Reston said that the savage transformation of Indonesia from a pro-Chinese policy under Sukarno to a defiantly anti-communist policy under General Suharto is, of course, the most important of a number of hopeful political developments in Asia that he saw as outweighing Washington's more widely publicized setbacks in Vietnam. Reston knew Washington's foreign policy establishment very well. Back in the 1950s, he was a frequent guest at Frank Wisner's raucous Sunday night dinner parties in Georgetown. In his final days, before he took his life, it's not clear how much attention Wisner was paying to the news, or if he even knew what happened in Indonesia at all. For writers like Reston, this was an obvious victory for U.S. geopolitical interests, as Washington understood them at the time. And for hardened anti-communists around the world, the method behind this savage transformation would soon be seen as an inspiration, a playbook. But how could the international press and the State Department remain entirely untroubled by the fact that this was achieved through the mass murder of unarmed civilians? Howard Federspiel at the State Department summed up the answer perfectly. No one cared, he recalled, as long as they were communists, that they were being butchered.